blind, have low vision, or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Dan, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 3rd, January 4th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, starting on the front cover. Next Class of Senators Faces Social Security Crunch by Richard Rubin, Washington. Senators elected this fall will find that Social Security's future insolvency is their problem. After years of Congress sidestepping and postponing the issue, the lawmakers will have to confront the program's challenges before their new six-year terms conclude. Recent projections pegged late 2032 as the moment when Social Security reserves and incoming tax revenue won't yield enough money to pay full benefits. Failure to act would trigger automatic benefit cuts. Acting is no picnic either, because raising revenue or reducing promised payments could be politically painful. It's been disappointing that we have kicked the can this long, said Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, a frequent participant in bipartisan deficit reduction talks, who is seeking a fourth term this year. Social Security's Day of Reckoning has long been seen as an issue for future presidents and Congresses, but the cliff is now entering a political calendar pulled forward by the pandemic's ripple effects and Congress's decisions to expand benefits and cut income taxes that help fund Social Security. The math is brutal for the program, known for many years as the third rail of American politics. Social Security owes lifetime benefits to the huge generation of baby boomers who are already retired or almost there. That commitment locks in costs that are virtually impossible to dislodge and puts younger workers and future retirees on course for tax increases, benefit reductions, or both. Congress last made major Social Security changes 43 years ago in a less partisan Washington, staving off insolvency with just months to spare by adopting tax increases and benefit cuts intended to make the program last 75 years. Since then, Americans have been bracing for more changes, with polls showing many doubt they will get their full checks. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina seeking his fifth term this year, said the 1983 agreement between the Republican President Ronald Reagan and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill is the model. "I'm willing to do my part," Graham said. "You've got to look at age adjustments, you know, means testing benefits. You've got to put it all on the table." Asked about taxes, he repeated, "All on the table." Past efforts have proved politically punishing. A second term push by Republican President George W. Bush to create private accounts collapsed after fierce Democratic opposition. Later, bipartisan initiatives never gained traction. President Trump has ruled out Social Security benefit cuts, breaking from many Republicans' openness to the idea. The debate has been mostly dormant for a decade, and the program now requires larger changes to preserve solvency because smaller options that accumulated over time no longer yield enough money. "We've already absorbed most of the cost of waiting," said Mark Goldwein, senior vice president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which favors deficit reduction. "The program's cushion is running out faster than previously projected. The pandemic accelerated retirements, decreasing fertility, and immigration can shrink the ratio of workers to retirees. The bipartisan Social Security Fairness Act that became law in early 2025 increased benefits to some state and local government workers. Because the trust fund also receives income taxes on benefits, the new Republican tax law accelerated the insolvency date to late 2032 from early 2033, the program's chief actuary told lawmakers last summer. Then the program's revenue will cover only about three quarters of benefits. Congress could temporarily use disability fund money to prop up the retirement fund. On a combined basis, the two funds became insolvent in early 2034. The country could borrow or dip into general fund revenue. In the long run, lawmakers try to avoid that option because part of what makes Social Security popular is its structure as a self-sustaining program with dedicated revenue streams. Social Security is excluded from the simple majority budget process Congress used for recent partisan fiscal laws such as Trump's tax cuts, meaning any bill would require 60 votes in the Senate. Any durable bipartisan solution will likely have tax increases and cuts to future payouts. There is no shortage of ideas. On the tax side, the prime target is the cap on the 12.4% payroll tax. Currently, wages and self-employment income above $184,500 are exempt from the tax, with the figure rising annually with inflation. That tax now covers about 83% of earnings, down from about 90% just after the 1983 changes. Just eliminating the cap would cut Social Security's long-run deficits in half. Taxing earnings above $250,000 and tying no new benefits to those earnings would remove about two-thirds of the shortfall. But that approach would change Social Security's basic architecture that links taxes paid with benefits earned. Both options would sharply raise top marginal tax rates. Raising the cap and devoting the money to Social Security is probably one of the few palatable ways Congress could get a significant revenue from high earners outside the top 1%, said Kathleen Romig, Director of Social Security and Disability Policy at the Progressive Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. That might push Democrats toward raising but not eliminating the cap, then using other taxes on very high income people to address priorities outside of Social Security. There are other revenue options, such as broadening the payroll tax base. Progressives have called for applying it to investment income. Congress could tax compensation that is now exempt, such as fringe benefits and employer-sponsored health insurance. On the benefit side, the system is progressive, replacing a greater share of income for workers with lower lifetime earnings than higher earners. Lawmakers try to protect people who rely on Social Security as their main income could alter calculations so higher earners get less money than under current rules. It makes sense to rethink what the benefit formula looks like, Romig said, especially because higher income retirees likely have significant savings in 401k-style plans. Goldman's group suggested different cost of living adjustments at different income levels, so the top quarter of earners would get the same dollar increase instead of the same percentage increase. That would close about 10% of Social Security's long-run shortfall. Congress could slow annual inflation adjustments for everyone, following a proposal President Barack Obama offered in a deficit reduction talks. That idea failed with the rest of a grand bargain with Republicans. Lawmakers could also increase the basic retirement age. The 1983 changes pushed that to 67 from 65. We will solve this problem because it has to be solved, said Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon. Even if it is in the ugliest possible fashion at the last second, it will be solved. Inside Musk's Pivot to Humanoid Robots by Becky Peterson. The future of Tesla is an army of humanoid robots that Elon Musk says could eliminate poverty and the need for work. He has told investors the robots could generate infinite revenue for Tesla and have potential to be the biggest product of all time. Musk has bet the company and his personal fortune on this vision of the world in which Optimus, as it is known, works in factories, handles domestic chores, performs surgeries, and travels to Mars to help humans colonize the planet. Though today each robot is made by hand, Musk is proposing manufacturing millions of robots a year. Optimus still has a lot to learn about the world before it is capable of replacing its human creators in the type of full-scale societal shift that Musk has in mind. In public appearances, the robot is often remotely operated by human engineers. On the engineering side, it has proven difficult for Tesla to create a hand for the bot, with both the sensitivity and dexterity of a human. Inside Musk's companies, some employees have questioned the usefulness of the bots for routine business operations like manufacturing. Musk is motivated to prove the skeptics wrong. His new compensation package gives him 10 years to make Tesla an $8.5 trillion company and sell at least 1 million bots to customers, among other product and financial goals. Success could mean earning Musk a $1 trillion pay package and expanding Tesla far beyond the electric vehicle industry where it made its mark. The car is to Tesla what the book was to Amazon, Adam Jones, an analyst with Morgan Stanley, said this summer. Tesla used cars as a laboratory to get good at other things. On Friday, Tesla reported its vehicle sales fell 16% in the fourth quarter and dropped 9% for all of 2025, leaving it behind China BYD for the year. Tesla's share price, which tumbled in early 2025 as the company's EV sales slumped, has rebounded in recent months amid optimism in Musk's pivot to robo-taxis and humanoid robots. Optimus is still under development, but the bot has become a familiar sight at company events and for many employees. Inside Tesla's Palo Alto, California engineering headquarters, robots routinely circle the inside perimeter of offices, gathering information on how to navigate a room alongside humans. In Tesla's labs, the nearly 6-foot-tall machine practices rote tasks like sorting Legos by color, folding laundry, and using a drill to screw a fastener, former employees said. In October, the bot made its red carpet debut at the Tron RA's premiere in Hollywood, performing a choreographed fight sequence with actor Jared Leto. Tesla is one of several companies pushing the frontiers of robotics in the hopes of cornering a nascent market. A crowd of Silicon Valley startups like 1X and Figure, other manufacturers like Hyundai's Boston Dynamics, and Chinese robotics companies are eager to sell their robots that can fold laundry or manufacture vehicles. Today, there are limits on how much robots can do. Many factories, including Tesla's, rely on robotic arms to do heavy lifting or dangerous tasks like moving hot metal. Those robots are largely stationary and programmed to do specific tasks. That leaves humans with jobs that require flexibility and precision, like installing cables or seats into cars moving across an assembly line. Humanoids have an obvious appeal. Bipedal with flexible joints, robots like Optimus are designed to function more easily in spaces meant for humans. Roboticists, however, have struggled to design robots with enough dexterity, sensitivity, and adaptability to move around freely, said Ken Goldberg, a roboticist at the University of California, Berkeley. I've heard Elon Musk say hands are the hard part. It's true, but it's not only the hand. It's the control, the ability to see the environment, to perceive it, and then compensate for all this uncertainty. That's the research frontier, Goldberg said. Getting these robots to do something useful is the problem. Some Tesla analysts have struggled to price Tesla's opportunity with humanoids given how new the industry is and exclude it from their financial models. Even Tesla bull ARK Invest, which expects Tesla's share price to climb to $2,600 from around $400 today, left Optimus out of its model for 2029 because it doesn't expect the product to be commercially successful until later on. Morgan Stanley's Jonas, who now covers the robotics industry, predicts that by 2050, humanoids will bring in $7.5 trillion in annual revenue across the industry globally. Capturing even a fraction of that market could supersize Tesla's revenue, which came in at $98 billion in 2024. At first, it seemed like a joke. Musk unveiled Tesla's bot concept at an event in 2021, with a human dancing on stage dressed in a robot costume. When Musk returned to the stage a year later, he demoed a prototype called Bumblebee with visible wires and actuators. Behind the scenes, Tesla engineers were working out of a kitchenette on campus. Soon after, the expanding group of Optimus engineers moved to a basement, then a large parking lot in another building, one former employee said. Tesla struggled to find the right parts to build its robots and had to make certain components like its actuators, which power the bot's movements, from scratch. The big idea was to take Tesla's learnings from its self-driven technology, which uses software and cameras to autonomously drive vehicles. Musk told colleagues that its cars were just robots on wheels. The humanoids would need to learn how to move around indoor spaces and avoid safety risks like tripping and falling on top of a nearby human or pet. To solve this problem, Tesla hired human data collectors to wear cameras and backpacks and walk around collecting training data. Tesla had people collecting data in several shifts, running 24/7. Another solution was to collect data using Optimus itself. The company set up bots to circle the inside perimeter of its offices, learning how to navigate indoors. In October 2024 at Warner Brothers Soundstage in Burbank, California, Musk demonstrated his vision for cities replete with autonomous vehicles and robots. In a disco ball decorated rotunda, 5 Optimus bots performed a dance routine to Hathaway's What Is Love. Elsewhere on the lot, the bots served drinks while outfitted in cowboy hats and bow ties. Behind the scenes, Tesla engineers worked overtime to troubleshoot technical issues, according to people on the ground. While robots in the rotunda were programmed to dance, the other robots at the event were teleo-operated by engineers who wore body suits and virtual reality headsets. They guided the bots' interactions with guests, including while serving drinks behind the bar. Each robot on the ground required constant monitoring from several engineers, one in a suit teleoperating its movements, one with a laptop, and others standing nearby to keep track of the bot's physical performance. Inside Tesla's lab, Optimus proved pretty good at learning simple tasks. In May, the company shared a video that appeared to show Optimus performing various jobs in response to verbal orders from an engineer, such as putting trash in the bin, cleaning up crumbs, and moving a Model X part from a box. Tesla has backed away from its initial Optimus timeline of putting a commercial version to work into its own factories by the end of the year. The company is currently working on its third generation of the robot. In Tesla marketing materials, Optimus has a role as a domestic worker watering plants, unpacking groceries, and handling other household tasks, giving its owners time to hang out with their families. Who wouldn't want their own personal C-3PO R2-D2, Musk said in November, referencing the droid characters in Star Wars movies. This is why I say humanoid robots will be the biggest product ever, because everyone is going to want one, or more than one. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Kraft Heinz Mac and Cheese Test. Buzzy upstarts and supermarket knockoffs eat into market share of leading brand, by Jesse Newman. Kraft Heinz has all but owned the supermarket macaroni and cheese aisle for decades. So when the first boxes of an upscale brand called Goodles landed on store shelves in 2022, the company wasn't especially worried. A call went out in the Chicago headquarters to try it out. Employees bought a few boxes, cooked up the gooey meals in a corporate kitchen, and dug in. The verdict? Goodles Chetty Mac tasted good. Other flavors, the testers decided, needed work. The noodle texture was a bit iffy. Kraft Heinz employees said the market-leading product was due for an upgrade, but with $1 billion worth of it selling every year, executives weren't in a hurry. Deliberations stretched on for years. More protein, new flavors, more cheese. Goodles has now gobbled up 6% of the U.S. mac and cheese market, while Kraft mac and cheese is down to 39% from 45% in 2022, according to data from market research firm Circana. When Kraft and Heinz, two of the biggest names in American food, merged in 2015, the combined company was supposed to breathe new life into old brands. Instead, years of cost-cutting, underinvestment, and corporate chaos left Kraft Heinz's $26 billion food empire, home to bedrock brands like Heinz's tomato ketchup, Philadelphia cream cheese, and Kool-Aid, vulnerable to both buzzier premium ones and cheaper supermarket knockoffs. Kraft Heinz sales have dropped for 8 straight quarters. In September, the company said it would split in two, undoing the 2015 deal. Tensions flared in the company's upper ranks. Many employees were uncertain who was calling the shots and which company they would end up working for, sowing further chaos. On January 1st, the company replaced its chief executive, Carlos Abrams Rivera, with veteran food company executive Steve Callahan. Big food companies are under siege, buffeted in recent years by heightened scrutiny of processed foods, consumer anger over soaring grocery bills, and the growing popularity of weight loss drugs. Kraft Heinz executives overseeing a sprawling portfolio of cheese, cold cuts, lunch kits, and boxed dinners face a dilemma shared by other legacy food companies. Fiddle with flagship products and risk losing the loyal customers who made them category killers, or stick with old formulas that don't interest young shoppers. Callahan, the new CEO, said in mid-December that the industry is clearly in a challenging moment and that Kraft Heinz has to meet the moment. Bankable brand. Kraft mac and cheese, first sold in 1937 for 19 cents a box, was the creation of Chicago cheesemonger James L. Kraft, who got his start selling cheese from a horse-drawn wagon. Marketed as a meal for four, it caught on during World War II, eventually finding broad success as a quick and convenient dinner for families. For decades, it was one of the most bankable brands in food. after Warren Buffett and Brazilian private equity firm 3G teamed up to buy ketchup heavyweight Heinz in 2013, they orchestrated a merger with Kraft, creating the world's fifth largest food company. Though Kraft mac and cheese still ruled store shelves, and the company's Velveeta shells and cheese also was a top seller, consumer tastes were shifting away from such processed foods toward fresher, healthier fare. Competition was mounting, with General Mills in 2014 acquiring Annie's, which made an organic mac and cheese. In an earnings call after the merger, Kraft Heinz executives called mac and cheese a turnaround opportunity. The company revamped the recipe in 2016, replacing artificial dyes with colors derived from natural sources. Kraft Heinz executives, many of them from 3G, used an aggressive cost-cutting measure called zero-based budgeting, under which all expenses had to be justified anew each year. The company closed plants and laid off thousands of workers, reducing annual spending by nearly $2 billion. It said greater efficiency would free up resources to reinvest in its brands. Dividends to stockholders jumped to $3.6 billion in 2016, from $1.3 billion the year before. Kraft Heinz boasted the highest operating profit margin among food companies. But former employees and Wall Street analysts said the company lost experienced leaders in marketing, research, and sales prowess. On multiple levels, they depleted the organization, said Rob Moskow, an analyst at TD Cowen. Kraft Heinz struggled to shift from cost-cutting to growth mode. Executives who excelled at trimming costs faltered when it came to building brands, according to former executives and other employees, often leaving junior employees to increase sales of struggling products on slim budgets. In 2019, poor sales and accounting errors prompted the company to write down the value of its assets by $17 billion. The company brought in a new CEO, Miguel Patricio, who pledged to reinvest in areas like marketing. Less than a year into his tenure, the pandemic hit, and homebound consumers flocked to familiar brands like Kraft Mac and Cheese. The company expanded manufacturing capacity to pump out more blue and orange containers of its signature product and other key offerings. Kraft Heinz sales climbed by 5% in 2020, by booming online orders. A year earlier, Paul Earle had been walking the aisles of Chicago grocery stores with a notebook and pen when he stopped in front of the familiar blue wall of Kraft boxes. The veteran consumer goods entrepreneur had been assistant brand manager for Kraft Mac and Cheese during a short stint at the food giant starting in the late 1990s. At the time, Earle recalled, he thought the product could be made more nutritious to satisfy Americans' growing appetite for healthy fare. Earle had left Kraft and later launched several companies, including one selling whiskey and shampoo. At the time of his Chicago store visit, he was hunting for a new project. He purchased several brands of mac and cheese, brought them home, and cooked them. His 10-year-old son, Earle said, spat out a healthier variety from a Kraft competitor. Kraft's classic version still tasted good and brought back fond memories, Earle said, but it didn't appear much healthier than it was when he worked there. I knew there was a way to do it better, he said. Earle approached Jen Zezut, who had run baby food startup Sarabelli. They agreed Kraft Heinz had left the door wide open for a mac and cheese challenge. Goodles, led by Zezut, pitched itself as a fun, healthier take on an old classic. The company infused its noodles with protein and nutrients from spinach, pumpkin, and kale, and said its ingredients and flavors warrant a price that is more than twice what Kraft sells for. While Kraft Heinz and General Mills tried to appeal to children with noodles shaped like SpongeBob and Disney characters, Goodles targeted a different group. Earle and Zezut believed many young adults were secretly eating mac and cheese, and others would too if it could shed its dorm food vibe. Goodles caught on with consumers. Zezut said retailers earned a higher profit on Goodles, turning them into fans too. It's a higher income consumer. It's a younger demographic, she said. It's exactly who they are trying to lure back to the center store. Slow reaction. Goodles hit store shelves during Kraft Heinz pandemic boom. Kraft Heinz executives weren't overly concerned about the new competition at first, former employees said. Kraft Mac and Cheese was the category's leading brand by far, selling more than a million boxes a day. there were other problems demanding attention. Mac and cheese was losing shoppers to other quick foods such as ramen, and many Kraft mac and cheese buyers were turning to less expensive store brands like Walmart's Great Value. In 2022, Kraft Heinz team proposed grabbing shoppers' attention with more promotions, new flavors, and a high-protein variety. Employees put together a proposal for a new mac and cheese products, including one using premium cheeses like Gruyere, Gouda, and Parmesan, and herbs and spices. Under a design-to-value approach the company had adopted, those employees needed to find corresponding cost cuts. They experimented internally with reducing the amount of cheese, mac and cheese's costliest component, checking the effect on taste, texture, mouthfeel, cheesiness, and cling, how the cheese sauce stuck to the noodles. A year later, another team made similar recommendations to executives, presenting sales data and retailer intelligence about Gen Z and millennial shoppers, many of whom were springing for premium versions. Health-focused options and new flavors like truffle and cacio e pepe, they said, could help coax back young shoppers. Executives faced other big troubles. Frequent restructuring and churn among employees led to shifting priorities, stalled projects, and frustration among retailers. Brands such as Oscar Mayer and Maxwell House posed even bigger challenges than macaroni and cheese. Kraft Heinz sales started dropping in late 2023. Consumers were fed up with inflation and hunting for deals. Patricio stepped down as CEO, turning over the job to Abrams Rivera. Executives were frustrated with Kraft mac and cheese, which continued to lose market share. Unhappy retailers wanted a growth strategy from Kraft, their biggest mac and cheese supplier. Costco wanted healthier products. Kraft Heinz's sales employees were frustrated too, believing their suggestions had fallen on deaf ears. Abrams Rivera acknowledged the mac and cheese challenges in an October 2024 earnings call. "We have quite a bit of work to do, and meaningful improvement will take some time," he told investors about several struggling brands. Employees drew up plans for new flavors, box sizes, and store promotions. Internally, they declared 2025 the year of mac and cheese. The company launched limited edition flavors such as pizza, garlic parmesan, and recently apple pie, and jalapeno ranch as permanent additions. As part of a major initiative to boost its brands, Kraft Heinz ran more mac and cheese taste tests with consumers. Some results were disappointing, and executives told employees to fix it, according to a person familiar with the matter. Diana Frost, the company's global chief executive officer, said one conclusion was that the product billed in the 1990s as the cheesiest could use more cheese. The company dialed up the cheese. It also introduced a bigger box that it says can feed a family of five for $2. Abrams Rivera said in October that mac and cheese was partly to blame for a 4% sales decline in the largest division of Kraft Heinz North America grocery unit. "We know our brands better than we've ever known them," Frost said. "We are not happy with where results are, but we're seeing progress." The company said it plans to spend more than $60 million to boost Kraft mac and cheese in 2026. Turning now to the world news. Iran's nuclear program spurred crisis, by Benoit Falcon. The first rumblings came on December 28th. Traders in shopping malls near Tehran's bazaar closed their stalls, complaining they couldn't earn enough to cover their bills. The rial, Iran's currency, has slumped to a historic low against the dollar, and inflation was surging again. Students worried whether they can find good jobs soon joined in as protests spread, leaving the government on the brink of what could become another crackdown. Iran isn't a typical candidate for a currency crisis. It is oil rich, with an educated population and a stock of foreign reserves. The issue is that its economic problems have a specific political source. Its leaders won't dial back their nuclear program, which they say is for producing cheap power, but which the U.S. and its allies fear is a cover for developing an atomic weapon. Political analysts say a compromise is needed to ease Western sanctions and provide the tools Iran needs to find a way out of the crisis. But talks between Tehran and Washington on restricting Iran's uranium enrichment program have made little progress. They have stalled completely since a 12-day war with Israel in June. Barring a deal over its nuclear program, Iran is likely to continue limping along toward deeper economic insolvency, recurring protest cycles, and a default reliance on force rather than reform to maintain control, said Sanam Vakil, director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the Chatham House, a think tank in London. So far, there is little evidence, if any, that Tehran will walk back its nuclear ambitions. Iran has suffered from years of economic mismanagement. The hardline Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps controls much of the economy and much of the government's budget outlays. Patronage systems allocate jobs, public works, contracts, cheap loans, and access to foreign cash, hollowing out the entrepreneurial class. Young Iranians are growing frustrated. The Islamic Republic has a high level of university enrollment, yet 1 in 4 of its youth are unemployed. Environmental problems such as water shortages are adding to the pressure, as is growing resentment among women against strict religious dress codes. But it is the immediate aftermath of the disastrous war with Israel that brought the swift dive in the Iranian rial, and with it, the latest crisis. The currency has lost some 60% of its value against the dollar since then, driving inflation to new highs. Food inflation hit 64% in October, according to the World Bank, the second highest level in the world after South Sudan. It will be difficult for Tehran's economic planners to arrest the slide. For years, international sanctions have restricted Iran's ability to bank and trade with the rest of the world, nor can it access the bulk of its foreign exchange reserves held offshore. International banks don't allow transfers to Tehran because of sanctions. Without access to reserves, the artificial pressure on the rial won't subside, said Esfandyar Batmanghelidze, chief executive of Iran-focused think tank Bors and Bazaar. Iran's oil wealth isn't doing it much good either. It possesses the world's fourth largest crude reserves and second largest reserves of natural gas, but is prevented from exporting most of it because of a U.S. oil embargo. The cash-strapped government is running out of options to cushion its population from the impact of sanctions, said Sina Tusi, senior non-resident fellow at the Center for International Policy, a think tank. While officials have said publicly they will listen to protesters' demands regarding the economy, Iran's parliament, the military, the security apparatus, and the judiciary have become dominated by hardliners. There is little room for new thinking. It remains to be seen how many shocks the system can absorb before it starts to fray, said Ruzbeh Alibada, an Iranian consultant at a geopolitical advisory firm Global Growth Advisors. Loyalty becomes harder when the family dinner table is running out. This is a reminder that you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Next article is Venezuela Exiles Support U.S. Moves. Many still living in the country, however, fear retribution and are focused on survival. And your reader would like to remind you that today is January 4th, 2026, which postdates the capturing of Maduro, so that is not captured in this article. Lima, Peru. The millions of Venezuelans who have fled the rule of Nicolas Maduro stand largely in solidarity with compatriots who stayed behind, except on the question of U.S. military intervention to change the regime. Most of the 8 million Venezuelans living in exile see American military action as the best shot to bring back democracy in a country they fear they might otherwise never see again, polls show. Many say regime change would persuade them to return home after years in foreign countries, mostly in South America, where they have taken low-level jobs and increasingly face anger from local populations from Chile to Colombia. They have watched with anticipation as the U.S. moved military assets to the Caribbean, conducted deadly airstrikes on boats allegedly tied to the regime, and blocked some oil exports. "It's my greatest hope," said Yamileth Chavez, who in 2018 fled Venezuela's oil-rich state of Zulia to Peru's capital, Lima. "The regime won't leave by playing nice." President Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio haven't said the military buildup goal is to oust Maduro, and have all but ruled out an invasion to topple him. But senior administration officials like White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, in a candid interview with Vanity Fair, have said regime change is the desired outcome, and Trump has said Maduro's days are numbered. About 64% of Venezuelans living abroad support a U.S. military intervention to depose Maduro, compared with 34% in the country, according to a recent Atlas Intel poll. Some 55% of Venezuelan migrants believe a U.S.-led military intervention is the most viable path to restoring democracy, compared with 25% for those in Venezuela, the poll showed. While people living in Venezuela also want Maduro gone, they are more focused on surviving soaring food prices than a U.S. military buildup and threats of land strikes. Freddy Marquez, a lawyer in Caracas, said his family managed rising food prices over Christmas, but he worries the oil blockade will hammer what's left of Venezuela's economy and fears U.S. intervention. "It would be catastrophic. Carlos Romero, a retired political science professor and consultant in Caracas, said people inside Venezuela have had a sort of delayed reaction to the situation and actions of the Trump government. People are focused on the day-to-day. Venezuelans are fearful of speaking out in a country where the state tortures dissenters. They are more apprehensive about the possible messy aftermath of U.S. military strikes because they would deal with the consequences, and they recall how previous attempts to oust Maduro failed. The diaspora is more willing to roll the dice and hope for the best than those who live in Venezuela and have more on the line, said Michael Shifter, a scholar on Latin America at the Inter-American Dialogue Policy Group. After a decade of economic calamity and repression, Venezuela's most consequential political constituency might now be among the millions who left, whose leaders in Washington and Miami have articulated strategies for regime change. The country's leading opposition activist, the Nobel Peace Laureate Maria Corina Machado, mostly has worked against Maduro inside the country, but she led a large group of exiled activists, many of whom met with senior U.S. diplomats, treasury officials, and conservative South Florida lawmakers to advocate for a harder line on Maduro. They have pitched an economic recovery strategy to show they can run the country with minimal upheaval the day after Maduro is out. Venezuelans abroad have struggled, leaving parents and children behind as they spread out across the globe. Some fled to the U.S. after trekking through jungles, only now to face the risk of deportation by the Trump administration. In Latin America, where nearly 7 million of more than 8 million have fled Venezuela reside, they have faced a backlash from some politicians who blame them for violent crime, though many are victims of criminal gangs that joined the exodus. Many of the exiled Venezuelans survived as street vendors, delivery drivers, and maids. They live in democracies and don't face the risk of imprisonment for speaking out. And so many of them are calling for swift measures, an invasion or airstrikes if need be, so they can return home to a democracy. We'd go back and give what's left of our life so that future generations can have a decent country, a country that we once had with democracy, said Cesar Pastrón, 63, a former university professor in Venezuela who now works in a call center in Chile. Maduro says he isn't going anywhere and sees Trump's military threats as a bluff. Maduro believes the only way the U.S. can remove him is by sending in troops, which analysts say is improbable. Chinese moves on Taiwan imperil Japan. Taipei's fate would quickly become intertwined with U.S.-Japan alliance by Niharika Mandahana and Daniel Kiss. After Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi recently suggested her country could mobilize a military response if China tried to seize Taiwan, Beijing responded with angry statements and warplane sorties. Its message? That is none of your business. But the economic and geopolitical reality is that a Chinese invasion across the Taiwan Strait would pose a significant threat to the interests of Japan and its biggest ally, the U.S. Taiwan, a democratically governed island, sits at a crucial maritime crossroads. A large portion of global trade passes through the South and East China Seas. Choke points such as the Bashi Channel sweep Taiwan's edges. A successful Chinese conquest of Taiwan would allow Beijing to dominate the region's strategic waterways, project military power widely into the Pacific, and more aggressively pursue its contested maritime and territorial claims. The balance of power in Asia would be tipped quite decisively in favor of China should Taiwan fall to China's hands, said Robert Ward, a Japan chair at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Looking seaward, China is sort of hemmed in right now, he said, referring to the first island chain, a string of archipelagos off the country's east coast made up largely of a trio of U.S. partners, Japan, Taiwan, and the Philippines. In a conflict, Taiwan's fate would become quickly intertwined with the U.S.-Japan security alliance. To repel a full-scale attack, Taipei would need America, its main defense partner, to join the battle. To fight effectively, American forces would need Japan. Geography presents particular challenges for Japan. A sweep of Japanese islands called the Ryukyu's arcs, southwest, stopping just short of Taiwan. The island of Yonaguni is less than 70 miles from Taiwan. Some of these islands would be right next to the war zone, or even in it, if China sent missiles and warships to blockade, batter, and encircle Taiwan. Hostilities across Otherwise, busy shipping lanes would disrupt essential trade Japan relies on. In recent years, as Tokyo has retooled its security posture in response to China's rapid military rise, it has sent a flurry of investments to these southwestern islands. That includes new bases, radar facilities, electronic warfare capabilities, and missile systems. Japan's Type 12 anti-ship missile batteries with 125-mile range are now positioned on a number of islands in the Ryukyus, and longer-range variants are being developed. If Japan participated in a conflict over Taiwan, these missiles and others it is making to hit targets farther out would play an important role, as would Japan's submarines and warships. A Chinese takeover of Taiwan would make the threat to Japanese territory more acute, said Yuki Tatsumi, senior director at the U.S.-based Institute for Indo-Pacific Security. Japan will no longer have a buffer, if you will, she said. Whether or not Japan joins a war over Taiwan, to what degree it fights and what it does if the U.S. stays out, depends on a mix of military, legal, and political factors. If Washington decided to militarily defend Taiwan, decisions made in Tokyo would shape the U.S. intervention. Japan hosts a network of strategically positioned American bases, sustained by robust infrastructure. U.S. forces fighting a long way from home would need to activate them, involving discussions between Washington and Tokyo. That includes Kadena Air Base, a hub of U.S. air power in the Pacific, and the U.S. Navy base at Yokosuka, home to the 7th Fleet and a forward-deployed aircraft carrier. The U.S. doesn't really have anything like the bases that it has in Japan elsewhere in Asia, said Eric Higginbotham, a principal research scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Security Studies Program. You can't replicate what you have in Japan. Without Japan, the U.S. would be heavily reliant on Guam, an American territory in the West Pacific about 1,700 miles from Taiwan. Bombers could use Guam, but fighter operations would be much harder to sustain, even with aerial refueling. Air superiority missions, for instance, would require them to sortie and remain on station in Taiwan's vicinity for a time before returning, which isn't viable from Guam, Higginbotham said. Turning now to the opinion section, review and outlook, the corruption of the welfare state. Republicans are having a field day with Minnesota's welfare fraud, and understandably so. But while Governor Tim Walz and Somali migrants may be easy political targets, the GOP will let the scandal go to waste if it fails to explain how vast government welfare payments have become an invitation for fraud and abuse. The Trump Health and Human Services Department Tuesday said it is suspending federal child care payments to Minnesota after a social media personality claimed daycare centers run by Somali residents committed up to $100 million in fraud. That assertion hasn't been corroborated, and over-egging fraud claims won't help reform. But Minnesota's varieties of government fraud are prompting welcome scrutiny of its welfare system. Visitors to the state government website could mistake it for an internet scam because it advertises so many handouts: cash, housing support, child care, food, emergency assistance, and more. These are on top of federal transfer payments. Herewith, a partial menu of what Minnesota residents can get from the state. Cash payments. Minnesota offers a working families tax credit of up to $3,089 a year, which operates similar to the federal income tax credit maximum of $8,046. Both credits phase out as incomes rise. Minnesotans can also claim $1,750 refundable tax credit for each child on top of the $2,200 federal credit. That's $4,000 per kid. Low-income Minnesotans can also qualify for a preloaded debit card to pay for incidental expenses. A single unemployed parent with two children can get $1,189 a month in additional cash payments. Minnesotans who can work can get more cash, but the work incentive is undermined by the state's other payments that phase out as paychecks grow. The state also operates a cash grant program for low-income families who face evictions, utility shutoffs, or other household emergencies. Forget to pay rent or the gas bill? The state has you covered. Once upon a time, the safety net was intended to help the disabled and sick who can't support themselves, not those who chose not to work, which is what it has become. Two distinct Social Security programs support people with disabilities, which can include depression and ADHD, and those with disabled children, though these have been abused, also been abused. Healthcare. Minnesota was a pioneer in using federal Medicaid dollars to pay for other forms of social assistance, such as housing, which is the locus of several fraud schemes. Two dozen states, including many run by Republicans, now tap Medicaid to pay nonprofits to provide housing support for the homeless or addicts. Minnesota also operates a quasi-public health insurance option funded by Obamacare subsidies. Rather than directly subsidize insurers, the feds send money to the state to manage its public option. Private insurers have a financial incentive to police fraud by providers. Government, not so much. Food. The U.S. Department of Agriculture operates 16 nutritional assistance programs, with the biggest being SNAP, aka food stamps. About 41.6 million Americans, including 455,000 Minnesotans, receive food stamps averaging $186 a month. Because many states have eased eligibility verifications, people often receive more than they're entitled to. The nationwide overpayment rate in 2024 was 9.3%, though somewhat lower in Minnesota at 6.3%. Minnesota is also one of nine or so states that provide free breakfasts and lunches to all students, no matter their family income. In the pandemic, Minnesota paid nonprofits to feed children. Much of the school lunch money was stolen, say federal indictments. Housing. The Department of Housing and Urban Development doles out some $60 billion each year to states and localities to subsidize rent for low-income households. In Minneapolis, low-income folks can receive $1,257 a month to rent a one-bedroom apartment. Rent subsidies phase out as incomes rise. Childcare. Minnesota provides heavily subsidized childcare for low-income families, partly funded by the feds. State subsidies are paid directly to childcare providers, which could enable fraudsters to set up fly-by-night daycare to bilk the government. Parents can also claim up to $2,100 a year in federal tax credits for daycare. Paid leave. Minnesota lets workers take up to 20 weeks of paid family and medical leave a year if they earned at least $3,900 in the prior year. The entitlement is funded by a 0.88 percentage point payroll tax. A worker who earned $4,000 in a year can receive as much as $5,538 in paid leave, according to a state calculator. With so much money and so many programs, this vast system is an open vault for scammers, especially when politicians are loath to police fraud because doing so might be called racist or anti-poor. But it's also corrupting for beneficiaries who have an incentive to remain on the dole rather than build an independent life. Republicans complain about fraud, but too few want to tackle the perverse incentives that allow it to flourish. Annual government transfer payments have increased by $1.7 trillion to $4.9 trillion since the start of the pandemic, roughly double the rate of inflation. Minnesota's problem isn't immigrants, it's the welfare state that corrupts them. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Minnesota isn't the only magnet for welfare malfeasance. At the Armory Inn and Suites, rooms boast, and this is reported by Kate Farmer in Orangeburg, New York. At the Armani Inn and Suites, rooms boast modern appliances and glossy wood furniture, while a chandelier hovers in the foyer near a swanky sitting area. Suitable for the business traveler, it seems an unlikely choice for the emergency housing of migrants. The city of New York, however, paid more than $800,000 for 4,902 room nights to put up asylum seekers in this hotel, some 30 miles north of downtown Manhattan. Yet no migrants ever stayed at the Armani, which became a symbol of rampant waste and abuse in the city's hapless contracting with human services companies and nonprofits. How did it happen? The New York City Department of Housing Preservation and Development in 2023 gave mobile healthcare company DocGo a $432 million contract for migrant housing. Because Mayor Eric Adams had directed agencies to use emergency housing procurements, DocGo didn't have to bid against any competitors. Although it had no prior experience providing housing or homeless services, DocGo received exclusive consideration. City Comptroller Brad Lander rejected the contract already underway, citing concerns about DocGo's integrity and responsibility and HPD's failure to justify the price tag. Mr. Adams overrode Mr. Lander and approved the deal. In the first 2 months of DocGo's contract, a comptroller audit found $11 million of its $13.8 million in invoices were unsupported. Expenses included $1.7 million for nearly 10,000 nights of empty hotel rooms, half of which were at the Armani, more than $2 million for unauthorized security staff and caseworkers, and another $2 million in staff hours that were never recorded. Yet Mr. Adams refused to terminate DocGo's contract, and by the end of its 12-month term, the city had paid the company $182 million. DocGo's CEO told the Journal in January 2024 that the company was providing the services the city contracted for and that most migrants were satisfied with them. 7 months later, in response to the audit, a DocGo spokesman said, "We are proud of our partnership with HPD." In 2024, the city's Department of Investigation released a sweeping report on human services nonprofits funded by the city. At all 51 nonprofits it examined had at least one finding of misconduct. More than 80% had at least three, 30% had five or more. Examples included shelter insiders funneling millions to personal businesses, executive salaries of more than $700,000 a year, and a CEO who put several family members on the payroll. One nonprofit, Sebco Development Inc., hosted a competitive bid for a contract worth millions that its own subsidiary won. The report's investigators noted multiple instances of new contracts being steered to vendors already profiting from existing contracts, among other findings that underscore the need for greater accountability, transparency, and oversight in the city's human services sector. The Democrats in power didn't listen to these alarms. Instead, the Adams administration repeatedly bypassed competitive bidding and extending emergency social service contracts. During Mr. Adams' term, which ended Thursday, a quarter of all Department of Social Services contracts were renewed this way. Almost a quarter of existing contracts were renewed five times or more. One was renewed 11 times. Governor Kathy Hochul has committed similar blunders. Leaning heavily on emergency no-bid contracts, she came under fire in public fire in 2022 for granting a $600 million no-bid contract to a company whose founder was a longtime campaign fundraiser and donor, even as the company charged roughly double the market rate for its COVID tests. A spokesman for the company said in 2022 that its prices were very competitive at the time and the state specifications had driven them up. A 2024 bill that unanimously passed the state legislature would have required agencies to disclose publicly any contracts exempted from comptroller approval. Ms. Hochul vetoed it, and lawmakers declined to buck her and override the veto. From flagrant non-competitive bids to overextended emergency contracts and open markets, of fraud and nepotism, the disarray of New York City's social services harms everyone and benefits few. It also poses a special challenge for Mayor Zohran Mamdani, who in his campaign promised to unleash the public sector to build 200,000 units of affordable housing. Mr. Mamdani should proceed carefully. Without smart management, expect more paid-up vacancies at the Armani Inn and Suites and more government dollars down the drain. Ms. Farmer is a Joseph Rago Memorial Fellow at the Journal. Turning now to declarations by Peggy Noonan. We could use a return to gallantry. I don't want to sum up the year, outline hopes for 2026, predict, or warn. I want to say we all have to become better people. You won't get through the future without faith. You won't get through life without courage. And if you want courage to spread, and you do, you're safer in a braver world. You have to encourage it, give it a lift, give it style. That's what gallantry is. Courage is style. It's class. It's shine and burnish. As a virtue, it is close to my heart. We live in a culture of winners who must win, and if the others don't know you won, then you must tell them over and over, like Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez. We are the wealthiest and most glamorous. We are living the best lives. Amal Clooney's online won, the Pope's on hold. Are you not impressed? Gallantry never says it won. When someone's smart, we say he has brains, and if he's brave, he has guts. But gallantry isn't assigned a human part, and so must be a thing of the soul. Courage faces danger, but gallantry is the way you face it. Often it has to do with treatment of a weaker party. Often it's directed toward an individual or cause that can't repay you. It involves self-discipline, but isn't grim. It travels light, it is modest, has no bombast. It was nothing. We were all doing our best. A cold, snowy night in late November 2012 in New York Times Square, police officer Larry DePrimo was walking the beat and saw a homeless man standing barefoot on the sidewalk. Mr. DePrimo went to Skechers, bought a pair of insulated boots and socks with his own money, and helped the homeless man get them on. There was no expectation of notice, but a passerby took a photo and posted it online. Reporters tracked down DePrimo. He said he didn't expect the publicity, that his act was something I had to do. He kept the receipt for the books in his pocket to remind himself some people have it worse. Gallantry goes beyond duty. I should underscore here that it isn't some old dead virtue. a relic of the past. It has nothing to do with nights or nostalgia. It is alive. It exists. You know people who are gallant. You have witnessed gallantry and understand at this point that it is deeply countercultural. If you say it's old-fashioned, maybe that's because it requires effort you don't want to make. If it's increasingly rare, then it's increasingly precious. Gallantry for beginners. When I was a child reading movie star magazines, I read a story that gave me a window into an idea about how to behave. It was about Tony Curtis, new to Hollywood and unknown, a Bronx boy hoping for the life of an actor. He retells the tale in his 1994 autobiography, American Prince. He and his wife, Janet Lee, were invited to dinner at Cole Porter's apartment. Ethel Merman picked up a wine glass and gently squeezed the top. The wine glass was so delicate and her touch so assured that she could change its shape from round to oval without breaking it. Merman encouraged him to try it himself. I squeezed, and this beautiful, delicate wine glass shattered in my hand. Ethel, who was dear and kind, said, "Don't worry, kid. It could happen to any of us." And then she took her own glass and shattered it just to make me feel better. Gallantry takes responsibility. On the morning of January 15th, 2009, U.S. Airways Flight 1549, its engines hit by a flock of birds, hit the Hudson River. Pilot Chelsea Sullenberger landed the plane safely, brilliantly, and with his crew got the 150 passengers calmly disembarked and standing on the wings. As the plane began sinking, Mr. Sullenberger walked the cabin twice to make sure no one was left behind. All were saved. In the days afterward, what struck people was not only that you can land on the river or that an Airbus can float for a while, it was, "Did you hear about the pilot?" When asked what happened, he always replied with factual precision and modesty. He redirected praise to the excellence of the crew and the sturdiness of the plane. There was a kind of public relief. We're still making Sullenbergers. They aren't just people in World War II movies. Gallantry is being the victor and refusing to humiliate. It's Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox treating Robert E. Lee with perfect, calibrated respect, letting Lee's officers keep their sidearms and his men their personal horses. It is George H.W. Bush refusing to rub the Soviet Union's face in it when the West won the Cold War. He did this not only for practical reasons, a humiliated foe is a dangerous foe, but out of decency. Gallantry is male-coded and shouldn't be. A history of gallant women is the history of the world. Famous examples, Jackie Kennedy, who her life blasted away on a Friday afternoon, held her poise and on Monday maintained public ritual in the funeral of her husband because the country needed it and history demanded it. Queen Elizabeth II was gallant throughout life, but especially at the end. Old and unwell, often in discomfort, she continued to meet with new prime ministers, some of whom she would have understood to be silly, and did it smiling in a friendly way in her cardigan and skirt. And in the end, her Jubilee video with Paddington Bear confiding she keeps marmalade sandwiches in her bag and keeping time with her spoon as "We Will Rock You" announced itself from the Royal Military Band outside Buckingham Palace. Margaret Chase Smith taking to her feet in the U.S. Senate and telling the truth, knowing the price she'd pay, while the he-men in the chamber ran in terror from Joe McCarthy. Sir Thomas More on the scaffold of Tower Hill comforted his executioner and was reported by a witness to have repositioned his beard on the block, joking it had committed no treason. On being asked by a pious official if he really knew God's judgment, he is said to have responded, "He will not refuse one who is so blithe to go to him." He didn't say my actions were right. He said God has a heart. Why are we banging away on all this as the clock ticks down to a new year? Because gallantry is necessary. Modern life strips away too much. Old protections aren't honored. Someone has to make things better. Because we live in a cold political world of cocoons, bubbles, and silos, and few feel safe to occupy the land between. It is a world in which people are obsessed with claiming their rights and not accepting their duties. Public speech is mean, strength is vulgar. Gallantry goes against all this. It says you can push without humiliating, be decisive without being brutal. It shows we can be better. It proves we are better. Onward, gallant ladies, gallant gentlemen of America. Welcome 2026 warmly and save it modestly.
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or